Suddenly it's Christmas, right after Halloween. Forget about Thanksgiving, it's just a buffet in between. There's lights and tinsel in the windows, they're stocking up the shelves. Santa's slaving at the North Pole in his sweatshop full of elves. There's got to be a build-up to the day that Christ was born. The halls are decked with pumpkins and ears of Indian corn. Dragging through the falling leaves in a one-horse open sleigh. Suddenly it's Christmas, 7 weeks before the day. Suddenly it's Christmas, the longest holiday. When they say season's greetings, they mean just what they say. It's a season, it's a marathon, retail eternity. And it's not over till it's over and you throw away the tree.
Welcome back to a special RN Breakfast for this Christmas morning. You're with Noel DeBean and me, Rachel Kahn, and Loudon Wainwright III there with his cynical take on Christmas.
Well, Christmas can seem like a marathon. I know Geraldine Duke said she found it really challenging trying to live up to all the beautiful Christmases her mother Peggy put on. And she only started enjoying Christmas as an adult when she stopped demanding so much of herself.
That's very hard for women. It's exhausting to be in charge of the present buying, as most women are, the food preparation, and definitely the card writing. But maybe the new challenge is to let go of the pressure and to hold on to something of the magic and joy we felt as children.
There is a really pretty poem by Thomas Hardy, and it's called The Oxen. And it goes to exactly that, Rachel. The yearning for Christmas is about childhood. And it's based on an old folk legend, one that cattle would kneel down at midnight on Christmas Eve. And it was published on the front page of the Times newspaper on Christmas Eve 1915, 100 years ago exactly, while men were dying on the front. And it's about the poet's adult loss of belief. And not just in the oxen kneeling at the manger, but in the future of humanity.
Christmas Eve, and 12 of the clock. Now they are all on their knees, an elder said as we sat in a flock by the embers in fireside ease. We pictured the meek, mild creatures where they dwelt in their strawy pen. Nor did it occur to one of us there to doubt they were kneeling then. So fair a fancy few would weave in these years. Yet I feel, if someone said on Christmas Eve, "Come, see the oxen kneel in the lonely barton by yonder coombe our childhood used to know," I should go with him in the gloom, hoping it might be so.
Shelton there, best remembered for singing inspirational songs for soldiers at the front during the Second World War, on the radio and in person in British military bases.
So, the stable, the ox, the ass, the magi, all that traditional imagery and the way the story has been handed down in popular culture through nativity plays and carols. Father Richard Leonard, who's a Jesuit priest and director of the Catholic Film and Television Office, joins us now with John Cleary, presenter of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio, to explain where a lot of it came from.
we can actually say that St. Francis of Assisi gave us a scene that we now have. In 1223, St. Francis of Assisi goes to a town to celebrate Christmas, and he decides to build a nativity scene. It was a huge hit, and it went everywhere. We would now say it went viral. And he was also the one, we think, who brought in, because he had a great love of animals, ox and ass. We sing about that. We've sung about that last night and today in carols and church services. Well, there's no named ox or ass in the story of the New Testament in Matthew or Luke. There's no donkey for Mary to ride on. We're not told that she has a baby that as soon as she arrives. We don't know when it happens. We're simply told that she had it while she was there. There's no innkeeper. Now, this is being a bit picky because they're turned away from an inn, but of course we've turned it into a character, a wonderful innkeeper who then does the dirty on them and won't let them have. Then they'll get the manger. And Francis of Assisi turned the manger into this beautiful thing with hay. Well, actually, a manger in New Testament times was a cave where animals slept, and that's where we get the ox and the ass from. But so they're not named. It was a cave, probably, at the back of where animals slept, and it was a pretty awful, terrible place. There are no three wise men. We have three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, but quickly the tradition established not only were they there were three men who bought it, but there were three kings, and then in the
and
third...
And they were named.
They were named, Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar. Well, they got those names in the third century. So we have no three kings, actually. They're called magi, and they were either astronomers or magicians. But because magic was always a bit dodgy for early Christianity and it had other pagan connotations, very quickly in religious art they end up Persian kings.
This is asset stripping. I mean, these things were added because they added value.
And people loved them. Like, there's nothing wrong with it. But if you're strictly getting back to the bare details, then I don't want to strip Christmas from any of these assets, you should say, because I think they're just wonderfully warm, rich, and they're all about the family story.
What about other aspects, like the candles and wreaths and holly and all of that?
We've got to thank the Germans for a lot of these things. I think it was very dark in northern Germany, and a lot of these were local home customs that come in. Like, for instance...
out of the ancient pagan traditions?
Well, they did. The Etruscans, particularly the Advent wreath, those of us who are going to church throughout Advent, well, we've been lighting Advent wreaths and candles. That's a completely German custom. They used to be a sign of status, sign of power, a reward, or a fashion statement, and then they were also used at processions for funerals, and they were also used in Advent. And when the German Lutherans and the German Catholics went all over the world, they took those home traditions with them and they took off.
What about gift giving?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Gift giving, well, Santa Claus, of course, is modelled on an actual saint called St. Nicholas of Lycia, and that's in modern day Turkey. And it would appear that he gave gifts to the poor and encouraged his people to do so. And they put them in stockings, and that's where we get the Christmas stocking from this day. Your old stockings, you stuffed your gifts for the poor and gave them to them, and they were given out on Christmas Eve to those who had nothing. In Dutch, Santa Claus was a variation on the theme of Saint Nicholas, but it was Luther who started the tradition of giving gifts to his own children, and then that spread. Boxing Day is an interesting one, of course, because that's the day when employers gave their workers gifts in medieval Europe as a way of saying thank you for all of the year's work. And so it was an opportunity to open the boxes to see what you'd received from your employer. And, of course, it's come down to us as the greatest shopping festival in the world.
What's interesting about much of this is even though Christmas has been largely commercialised in the West and the religious elements have been sort of filtered out, so Santa Claus takes the place of the baby Jesus, we still have this hunger to honour a day, to make a festival that has to do with giving.
Well, last night at St. Mary's, North Sydney, where I help out, Jesuit parish there, the place was absolutely packed from one mass to the next to the next. And I said, you know, some of you belong to the Catholic Secret Service. You can only blow your cover once a year by coming to church, but it's fantastic you're here. People get to this feast day, and even the most secular heart seems to think, I want to go and sing a carol, and I want to touch again a tradition of giving, of being kind to the poor, of being with family and friends. And, of course, that's actually at the heart of the message. So whatever of all the trappings, the message is a wonderful thing about family life. It's about redemption. It's about salvation. It's about changing the world. And it's about light coming into all of our darkness, whatever that darkness might be.
This emphasis on the poor got a particular particularly strong kick along in the Victorian era with Charles Dickens and A Christmas Carol, and that seemed to invest a whole new layer of meaning that continues whether you're religious or not.
A couple of things happened there. The royal family in England, Prince Albert brought a terrific number of those German traditions over into England when he married Queen Victoria. For instance, he bought the Christmas tree and he bought gift giving to the poor, which apparently was part of his own tradition in Saxe-Coburg. And Dickens is writing, there are desperate poverty among working class people in England. And then that tradition goes all over the world to this day, that all the major charities have been telling us, and rightly so, that if we're going to spend an extraordinary amount of money on ourselves this day, something has to be given to those who have nothing. And Australians actually are very generous to people around and on Christmas Day.
We still have the need to invest meaning in the rhythm of our lives. And Christmas still seems, I think probably because it's associated so closely with the new year, to have that atmosphere about it.
Well, I think it's all about life and death. Where have we come from? Why are we here? And where are we going? And we still struggle with that. What are the meaning and identity questions? And Christmas plugs right into that, because the story itself, actually the baby comes that in the process of his life will be killed for the way he lived. And through that, we will find the way to our own redemption and salvation, and life eternal will be opened up. That's Christian theology. So the story is beautifully linked from Christmas to Good Friday. And that's an extraordinary combination when you think about it. There's a beautiful African-American spiritual song that's, "Poor little Jesus, don't you know this world's going to break your heart?" And it's a very mournful carol, but I find it very moving because it actually links what many of us are looking for in our lives. How do I make some sense of not only my birth, my living, but also about my dying?
Reverend Dr. Richard Leonard, Catholic Film and Television Office for Film and Broadcasting, thanks so much for joining us on this Christmas morning.
A very happy Christmas to you, John.
Hail, hail to the newborn King, let our voices sing Him our praises. Hail, hail to the guiding light that brought us tonight to our Savior.
Lou Harris and the 1970s folk carol, The Light of the Stable. Well, coming from Toronto in Canada, where it was always a white Christmas, I'm still fascinated by how Christmas is spent differently in Australia. So I asked Ingrid Robertson, a young mum and the vicar of a little parish in Barara in the rural outskirts of Sydney, to join us this morning to tell us what Christmas means in her neck of the woods. Is she the Australian version of the Vicar of Dibley?
Oh, I do love that show. No. I'm not at all like her. I'm not half as funny. We don't have our fair share of quirky characters that are on the show. We have no Mrs. Cropley and we have no Owen.
So without the eccentric characters.
That's a good word.
Still, there must be quite a degree of uniqueness about being in a country parish.
I don't think the members of my congregation would consider themselves a country parish. Technically, we're part of Sydney, and we're in an area that's actually surrounded by bush. So there's one way in and one way out. There's no escape. There's a strong sense of community and a strong village atmosphere, but still it's the outskirts of Sydney.
So with that kind of village atmosphere, what is happening in the parish at Christmas?
Oh, there's a lot on. We've had our carols by candlelight, which was a wonderful opportunity to just be part of the community, not in a commercialised sense, but just get the community together to sing. And we had our, we call it our unrehearsed Christmas pageant, which is on the Sunday before Christmas, and everyone comes dressed as a character. We can have one Mary, we can have four Marys, we can have three wise men, we can have no wise men. We just roll with it.
Is it only children who dress up, or does everyone?
Adults tend to step in when we don't have a character we particularly need. And some adults come dressed. We have spare outfits on the day for anyone who feels inspired. Or I remember last year, our Mary got extreme stage fright about 2 minutes into it. So someone had to step up and become Mary's older sister who walked with her the whole experience. It was fantastic.
Well, Mary was under a lot of stress after all, giving birth to a child that was the most unique child in the history of the world. People are often quite cynical about Christmas. Have you ever bought into that sort of humbug attitude?
No, I married the humbug of our family. I've always been a fan of Christmas. Always.
Why do you love it?
Oh, I love the colour and I love the scent and I love the fact that it's the time when most people get together as family if they can. And some people make up their own family. It's the one time of year when people prioritise being family and being community. And it's also the one time of year when people actually reflect and consider how lucky they are. You know, it's the one time of year when most people will donate to communities, to those who are struggling. It's a time when we consider beyond ourselves.
So the gift giving, which is at the center of Christmas,
mm-hmm.
Well, there's gift giving at birthdays and lots of other, you know, occasions. But at Christmas, the gift giving can go outward to others,
yeah.
Beyond the family,
yep.
People in need.
Yep. When it's a birthday or a Mother's Day or Grandparents' Day or whatever, and someone receives a gift, it's always about that individual. Whereas at Christmas, it's much more about the community. We give gifts to others, they give gifts to us, and the gifts don't actually have to be material. Sometimes, at least in our community, the gifts are an offer of babysitting or an offer of dinner or something that's more an experience than a piece of plastic.
Ingrid, how do you offset the Santa Claus aspect of Christmas with the Jesus-centered aspect,
yep.
the other male person at the center of Christmas? How do you communicate the message of Christmas that focuses on the birth of a child?
It's interesting. We've never really raised the issue of Santa. We've just let the boys make up their own concept of Santa. Through daycare and all their friends, they've worked out that you write a list and you give it to Santa. But we've never done the sending a letter to Santa.
Your husband hasn't dressed up in a red suit?
No, no. But at least my five-year-old, when I asked him this morning, what's Christmas about? He said, Christmas is Jesus's birthday. So he, at the moment, he can hold the two thoughts together. As he grows older, perhaps that'll change. But at the moment, he can hold the two thoughts together.
How traditional are you in respect to the Christmas tree?
I am very much a fan of Christmas decorations, of lights, of trees, of nutcrackers, of nativity scenes. And I've spent my life collecting them from all over the world. And I have a beautiful tree. But now I also have children, and they create glitter and Christmas decorations out of paddle pop sticks, which now take pride of place on my beautiful tree.
Oh, no.
So I'm trying to let go of some of that control and recognize that the tree has become the family tree rather than my tree.
Well, all those sorts of things can mm-hmm. happen.
But they make the wonderful memories. And it's the memories that take you from year to year.
Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol has been read out to children for, well, over a century, and certainly has been watched on television. Does that story still, you know, have legs, as it were, today in the Australian scene?
It certainly does, in that Christmas is a time often when people reflect on their life and the previous years, and also on what they hope for their future. For many of us, not all, but for many of us, when we write a Christmas card, we will say Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. There's a recognition of the now, of the Christmas, but there's also a recognition of may next year be full of joy and may next year be full of hope. There's a future involved in the celebration. And I think that's what Charles Dickens, that's one of the aspects he was writing about. What we do now affects our future. So for Scrooge, his actions now affected all of those who worked with him and all of those who worked for him. And it was once he changed his actions in the present that their future became a lot brighter.
Well, Ingrid, happy Christmas to you and all your family.
And to you and to all of your listeners. May today be a day of blessed joy and hope, and may the future be bright.
Amen to that.
Amen.
Michael McKenzie, who presents RN Afternoons, played me that recording recently, and I just had to get him to tell me the story. Michael, isn't that stunning? You feel like you're right up there in the bell tower with the choir, who sound amazing. How did you find out about them?
Well, we all receive lots of lovely emails from the audience suggesting stories, and you sift through them, and occasionally you strike one that makes you want to reach out even further than usual. And Michelle Farron is a local teacher in the Bombala region of New South Wales. She happens to teach just over the border in Victoria in the most remote school there. The total population of that school is apparently, I think, at peak capacity, 14 students. There was only 8 when I rang. Anyway, Michelle emailed and said, look, Michael, there's this choir that I'm part of. And she duly sent 4 songs, and that is the quality that blew my mind. And so I just wrote right back and said, this is extraordinary performance, singing and a choral work I've never heard in such a way from a community choir. We must do a story. And so we did.
Well, Michael, you'd think that recording we just heard was done in Abbey Road Studios or something. I mean, but they're
with
in
the King's College singers.
Exactly. You know. But yeah, there they are in Bombala in southern New South Wales. How do they achieve that sound?
Well, there's a couple of factors at play here. One is that the choir in its lineup has mostly, I mean, it's come and gone in terms of members. There's about 30 of them, ranging in age from Michelle's daughter, who's 13, up to some other members who have been with the choir for its entire 14 years, and some of those members are now into their 80s. So they've been together a long time. That's one part of it. The other part is Klaus Zimmer. Klaus is a choir master who hails from Switzerland and was a timpani player in the Swiss professional orchestra, the National Orchestra, and he then worked in choirs at a sort of semi-pro level in Germany, as I understand it, has family connections to Bombala, has always loved the place, retired there with his partner Patricia, and between them, they have coached and led this choir to a level of excellence that has also resulted in this being the 4th CD of songs they've put out. Klaus was explaining the other part of this whole story is that he has a tiny recording studio at his house in Bombala, and he has, for the last 3 years, been inviting individual members of this 30-strong choir to come into the house, into the studio, one by one, and lay down their one singular vocal part amongst many. Wow. And then the next person comes in. It's taken 3 years for that to occur.
So he puts it all together. Now, you said he was from Switzerland, which makes me think he's got that kind of Swiss clock precision in his personality. Did you find him that way?
I found him incredibly warm, and I so love the fact that Klaus's name is spelled C-L-A-U-S, given when we're talking.
Oh, my gosh.
And Yes, it's true. And I don't know what Klaus looks like. I haven't met him personally. But in terms of conversation, he just evoked this beautiful warmth and a sense of community that radiates not only through the choir as people, but also through the community and the music. And apparently Michelle was saying, because I had both Klaus and Michelle on to talk about the choir, that Klaus has always been this figurehead for the choir because he's a Rotarian as well. So all the money raised from the CDs goes to causes like the fight against polio, for example, and at the same time gives this region, which has been under a lot of stress as a rural community for a long time, with declining prices for commodities off the land, declining population, it gives a sense of morale to the community, a sense of purpose, and it's drawing in satellite communities around Bombala, tiny little towns with some great names. One of them was called Cathcart, I remember. It reminded me of Michael Cathcart. Mm-hmm. And another town just down the road from Bombala called Delegate. These are some of the names of towns. And Bombala, of course, originally was cited by King O'Malley back in about 1903 as a potential nation's capital. It could have been where Canberra is now.
What an amazing piece of information. Wow.
Mm, yeah.
Now, what do you mean that it's drawing in all of these other towns?
The choir is made up of a sense of region rather than just the community of Bombala. So I think there's about 1,000 people in Bombala itself. But because the region is an agricultural region, a lot of people know each other. There's generations of families living there, plus newcomers like the Zimmers. And they all pull together in times of need. And in the case of the choir, obviously, having 14 years now in terms of the choir's existence, the word's got out. And every time the choir puts out a new CD, it makes front page headlines for the Bombala local paper.
Gosh,
so everyone knows. Yeah.
The reversal of fortune by
indeed
through the arts, which is a really nice story.
Well, you can't make it rain and you can't necessarily get the best price for your milk, but you can give the community a sense of cohesion through voice and through celebration being uplifted in song.
And it's wonderful that it's intergenerational as well. You said there are young people, there are old people, people in between. That's a great sense of community, so different from the kind of cultural involvements now that seem to be so specific to specific generations.
Indeed. And I also love the fact that at the end of every rehearsal and performance, the choir all goes out to dinner at a local club.
So the restaurants and the clubs are making some money too.
That's right.
It's a great carol, and that is an Australian country congregation singing it. That recording came to us from a pretty remarkable multicultural carol service in St. Matthew's Anglican Church, Albury. Indigenous elders, local Christians, Baha'is, Jews, Buddhists, Hindus, and Muslims, everybody was there from the town. And this is part of the account of the virgin birth from the Quran, read at that service by Yaqub Muhammad.
Good evening to all. And in Islam, we say, the Muslims say, Assalamu alaikum. I'll be reading from the Quran, Surah Al Imran, which is, and mention when the angels say, O Mary, indeed Allah gives you good tidings of a word from Him, whose name will be the Messiah, Jesus, the Son of Mary, distinguished in the world and the hereafter and among those brought near to Allah. He will speak to the people in the cradle and in maturity and will be of the righteous. She said, My Lord, how will I have a child when no man has touched me? The angel said, Such is Allah. He created what He wills. When He decrees a matter, He only says to it, Be, and it is.
You're listening to Christmas Breakfast here on RN with me, Noel Debien, and Rachel Conn.
Last month, I went to a G20 conference in Turkey, looking at the constructive role religion can play in the world. I met a young Swedish girl, Jana Jakob, involved in some grassroots interfaith initiatives, similar to many going on in Australia, Noel, that we just heard about. But it was particularly interesting to hear how it works in Sweden, possibly the most secular country in Europe.
I feel like I have a responsibility because I'm so blessed with so many resources. I feel like I have a responsibility to use these resources wisely.
Well, many people, certainly in Australia, look to Sweden as the secular society par excellence. So how would you describe Sweden?
Sweden is, according to many different statistics, one of the most secularized countries in the whole world. And that's why it is quite hard to be a religious person in Sweden, especially when you're young and, well, I study at university. So people think that you would have to be naive if you are in need of a god. And how I experience it is that quite often people find it more acceptable to be a Muslim or a Sikh or a Jew than a Christian. For them, it clashes somehow to be, born in a European country, well-educated, and to be a Christian.
And yet Muslims today would also face a considerable degree of intolerance toward them?
Yeah, definitely. No, I'm not saying that it's harder to be a Christian in Sweden than to be a Muslim. But I was studying political science at Stockholm University, and one of my classmates, I told her that I was a Christian, and we had a seminar group meeting, and we also had a Muslim girl in our group who said, "I'll just go 5 minutes, I'll be back, I'll go pray." And no one thought this was strange, but then my friend asked me, "Wait, you're a Christian as well, do you pray?" I said, "Oh yeah, of course, this is part of what it means to be Christian." And then she was shocked because it didn't fit together for her that I would, well, be in need of a god and pray.
Well, you're involved in a very interesting development, which is called Together for Sweden. Tell me about that.
Well, Together for Sweden is an interreligious project which was started up at Fryshuset, which is a very big youth center in Stockholm and in the whole of Sweden. And it was started by a priest and an imam. And both of them felt that there was too little contact between the two religions. So they started to gather up this interreligious project, which of course led to criticism from all sides. But, today it's a big project. Now, Together for Sweden just received funding to start up a resource center, an interreligious resource center. And we have different things. We have an interreligious leadership education where young people from 16 onwards can study different religions sort of in a fun way. So we visit holy houses. We learn to think non-critical. We do different exercises about our own identity. And, well, the idea is just to build friendship across different cultural backgrounds. Another thing is that we hold lectures and workshops in schools, and that's what I've been doing a lot. So this works in a way that we're usually 3 or 4 young people from 3 or 4 different religions. And then we start the workshop with storytelling, which is telling our own stories within maybe 5 or 6 minutes. And then the students have to discuss our stories with some exercises, and in the end, there is a Q&A session. My friend Josla, for example, she wears a headscarf. She got the question, "Do you shower with that?" Things like that are we being asked, and we're just happy about that because in these questions we really realize how many prejudices and wrong ideas the students have just because Sweden is so secularized. Religion is taking place in the hidden realm a lot. So the problematic thing with that is that mainly the radical voices are being heard, and many people have never met a practicing Christian or Muslim. They just heard what's going on in the news, which does not give very much space to moderate, peace-loving believers.
That's interesting, because from what you described before about the secularized Sweden, it's clear that many from Christian backgrounds, though no longer believing themselves, would also learn a lot about the tradition, say, of their grandparents.
Yeah, definitely. The thing is that these people, what in other countries you might call them Christians anyways, but in Sweden, these people usually don't call themselves Christians. A scholar, David Thurfjell, has written a very good book about that, where he says how Sweden has developed. Today's majority of people, they are post-Christian. So they're not Christians, even though they go to church when it's big holidays, they maybe give Christian names to their children, they might even baptize them, but they might never call themselves Christians, because it's such a loaded word for many.
Well, you're also involved in something called an interreligious girls project. Tell me about that.
Well, this is actually the result of the storytelling workshops we hold. We were traveling all over Stockholm holding workshops for students in different schools, and that's when I personally realized how serious the segregation is in Stockholm. So in some schools, we could meet a whole class with only Muslim kids, not one single ethnic Swede in the class. And at the same time, we could come to schools where it's not one single student with a migrant background. And I was not aware of the seriousness of this situation. I just realized it when traveling throughout Stockholm. And I know that most people don't do this, and know that most people are not aware of desegregation.
What do you think is the reason for this segregation?
Well, it might be on the one hand, of course, you want to live with your own people. It's just more comfortable. That's what everyone does, basically. But on the other hand, housing prices are so extremely high in Stockholm that you can basically just live in the city center if you're very well off. So housing prices have been skyrocketing over a long time. Desegregation is, of course, enforced by that.
And you'll be able to hear a longer version of that interview on The Spirit of Things early next year.
Well, I'm aware of a lot of cathedrals and churches. Over the last week, you've had interfaith Christian services. I've been in one myself, actually, which does really say something about the changing face of Australia. Many new migrants, many different cultures, and all sorts of new traditions and rituals. Not just turkey making way for prawns.
And mangoes and cherries being as seasonal as plum pudding. Well, sharing food is part of the Christmas tradition. Isn't it Dickens' Christmas Carol that put the turkey front and center? But of course, not everybody has family and friends to spend Christmas with, and many of us look for something different to do.
Oh, if you're alone today, many church groups and community organizations put on special Christmas lunches. And increasingly, numbers of cafes and restaurants are open too.
And this year, there's been a new trend of cafes putting signs in their windows saying, if you can't afford a meal, come in anyway. And Lentil Is Anything in Melbourne and Sydney is one of those. Open 365 days a year, their idea is that food is a human right. Largely run by volunteers, there are no set prices. You just pay what you think the meal is worth or what you can afford to pay.
Earlier this week, Nadjat El-Ghorli checked out their cafe in Newtown in Sydney.
I come here for several reasons. I like the atmosphere. It's a very welcoming place. So any person, whether you're young or old, no matter what you're interested in, if you just want to come and sit and eat, you can do that. And you're welcome. I like the fact that you're actually welcome to be here. So you're honoured as a human being in being here. And you get to have a beautiful feed and you tend to meet really lovely people.
There's no limit placed on your generosity, so you can choose how much you want to contribute. And also that they encourage people to work here as well, so you can contribute through your labour. So you know that old joke where you go to a restaurant and you don't have money, so you can pay by doing the dishes here.
My main involvement is that we run a small social community cinema here, and it's all about raising awareness of different causes. Anyone can come and show their films to a wider audience.
My name is Annika Fernando. I'm the founder of Lentil Is Anything, which started in the year 2000. The basic principle of Lentil Is Anything is to provide food to the community without the hurdle of money, so that people from all walks of life can come and share a meal, share their culture with us. And this is our message, which is money is not important, people are important, and we want to learn about you, so come and share your story with us.
My name is Melinda Heinrich, and I'm currently a uni student at the Sydney University. I volunteered for about 10 months before any sort of job opportunity here came up. And I was here all the time, absolutely loved it. I always just kept coming back. When I started volunteering here, I was in a not so great place. And I decided I needed to do something in order to distract myself. And I was a very shy person. I didn't even want to talk to customers, did not want to take their orders. I definitely could not be talking to you right now. And just over time, I made friendships with customers, regular customers, and the chefs here and the other managers. I definitely respect more cultures. I had no clue about refugees, asylum seekers. I wasn't really into the news. I didn't really know anyone affected by that situation. But coming here, I realized like how important this issue with these asylum seekers is. And it's not something we can just forget about or just be like, oh no, we don't have to deal with it. Like, we are all people and we all deserve a place to feel safe.
I'm Sean. I'm the head chef here at Lentils Newtown. I love to cook and have a background in cooking vegetarian food and wanted to do a job that wasn't about the money. In my previous job, I was unpaid and working with volunteers, and I wanted to continue doing something like that. I find the commercial cookery world is a pretty nasty place to be in, and my experience has been that when you take money out of the equation, something really beautiful happens. So working in an organization like this is perfect for me, and I'm very lucky to be here. Most days I'm in the kitchen, so I come in early and I'm seeing what we have, looking at our prep, putting stuff together, thinking on my feet, constantly new faces coming in, people coming into the kitchen, learning people's stories, gauging, you know, what they can do, what their skills are, how they can help us and vice versa. It's a lot of kind of creative problem solving. And lots of our staff, customers, volunteers come from really diverse backgrounds. Everyone has different stories, and people are struggling with a lot of different things, difficult presents, difficult pasts. I think above and beyond being a chef, my job is mostly mediating and holding a space for people and trying to make sure that everybody's having a good time and getting the most out of the experience that they can.
The people who contribute traditionally have been people who really value and recognize what we do in the community. And often I don't think they are people with a lot of disposable income. They're people who are just generous, quite unassuming Aussies, which is a beautiful part of the Australian culture. I think, you know, because we don't have those musty traditions like in Europe and places, I think people have an instinctive sense of camaraderie that is very grassroots and based on mateship and helping each other.
Well, I think it's a place that, yeah, caters to a really diverse group of people. So I see school children here, tourists. Yesterday there was a group of like people who were here for their Christmas lunch. So it's a place where everyone's welcome.
I think there's very little that distinguishes us from each other. I think everyone has a common motive that they want to come together and have social connections in the community. It's not all about profit. It's about making friends, and so it's a common service basically to the community.
Thank you. Hello, Anne. It's Jane here. I hope you're keeping well. It's the 21st of December. Now they're ringing the last bell. If I get good behavior, I'll be out of here by July. Won't you kiss my kids on Christmas Day? Please don't let them cry. Guess her brothers are driving down from Queensland, and Stella's flying in from the coast. They say it's gonna be 100 degrees or even more, maybe. Ah, but that won't stop the roast. And who's gonna make the gravy now? I bet it won't tastes the same. Just add flour, soap, and a little red wine. And don't forget a dollop of tomato sauce for sweetness and that extra tang. And give my love to Angus and to Frank and Dolly. Tell them all I'm sorry. Screwed up this time. Look after Peter. I'll be thinking of him.
Powerful story. Young mum separated by a prison sentence from her kids and family at Christmas. It's a Paul Kelly song and it's reworked by Catherine Britt.
She's an Aussie girl from Newcastle.
Sure is. She spent 6 years, though, in her 20s living in Nashville, still only 30, and she's establishing herself as a bit of a force in country music.
Noel, the truth is, I don't like gravy, but that recipe just might do it for me.
We are at the gravy end of the program, I've got to tell you too. But it does strike me, as I get older, that it's not things that we want, things that money can buy. And the sorts of things, you know, time, appreciation, attention, kindness, those sorts of things.
Not sweating the big stuff?
Yep, patience, that's true.
Well, this last poem takes us back to where we started this morning and the idea that Christmas is about the ordinary as well as the extraordinary.
Do not ask your children to strive for extraordinary lives. Such striving may seem admirable, but it is a way of foolishness. Help them instead to find the wonder and the marvel of an ordinary life. Show them the joy of tasting tomatoes, apples, and pears. Show them how to cry when pets and people die. Show them the infinite pleasure in the touch of a hand, and make the ordinary come alive for them. The extraordinary will take care of itself.
Make the Ordinary Come Alive by William Martin. And I think it's worth remembering that, like the family in the original Christmas story, the best gift many people can hope for is a safe place to stay.
And that's why we think it's appropriate to end with a message from those seeking safety from the conflict that still reigns in the Middle East. It's a message of hope. Thank you to Melburnian Paul de Brouwer, who organized this Christmas message from one of the many refugee camps in northern Iraq. And thank you to Archbishop Warda, the Archbishop of Erbil.
Today we celebrate the birth of Jesus. We celebrate a refugee like us. We celebrate a homeless family like us, a family forced to sleep where animals are kept, a family forced through violence to leave their homes and to live in a foreign land. We are living this Christmas story today. I stand before you in this refugee camp in Ankawa, Erbil, Kurdistan, Iraq, to tell you, do not be afraid. God is love. 2,000 years ago, in this land, the Roman Empire believed that peace come from power, war and violence. Jesus Christ, a refugee from violence, told the world that a true peace comes from God's love, forgiveness and justice. And when God doesn't find a place in man's heart, man also does not find a place for his fellow man. This birthday is a celebration that is added to the celebrations of the year, so that it may be an occasion for welcoming God's love and for hospitality for man. We, the suffering people, exclaim to the world, to celebrate Christmas does not mean for us only to exchange congratulations and Shlama greetings, but also to pray so that man may calm down and extend a hand of peace and reconciliation with all. From this camp we tell everybody, enough with the struggles, enough with wars. We are tired of displacement. We are tired of homelessness. Let us work together so that all men may live in peace in their homes. This is our message to all the peoples and nations, bombed or free, rich or poor, to all the people in all the lands, to those who kill, rape and torture us, we forgive you. To those that want war, we bring peace. To those who hate us, we love you.
The Catholic Archbishop of Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan. The Pope's Christmas Mass from the Vatican is on ABC TV at 9:30 this morning, and the Queen's speech will be on ABC local radio after the 7 o'clock news tonight with John Cleary.
Well, let's go out on one of my special memories as a child growing up in Toronto, where Christmases were white, log fires were burning, and even chestnuts were warming on an open fire, which is all reimagined here in this carol by the American Jewish songwriter Irving Berlin.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow.
So that's it for this morning's Christmas breakfast. Just a final word of thanks to our producers, Nadiat Al-Ghali and executive producer Jane Jeffs. Additional research, Adam Adada. Studio engineer, Judy Rapley. The readers were Zoe Norton, John Steiner, and Hamish McDonald.
You can find details of all the readings, music, and interviews online. Just Google RN Breakfast. And that's it from us, Rachel Kahn.
And Nolde Behan.
We hope you have a happy and peaceful day.
All your Christmases.